Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, let's try it again. Shalom, this is Richard Address, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to today's installment of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows represent our desire to explore issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. We invite you to share comments and ideas with us at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com or on our Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page, if you go to that and like it or love it or whatever you do with it. And if you would like to be part of our conversation, we invite you to remember that these shows are archived as podcasts on jewishsacredaging.com. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the microphone here at Jewish Sacred Aging Radio today, Rabbi Dale Friedman, one of the all-stars of the American Jewish community dealing with issues around aging and spirituality. Dale is the founding director of Growing Older, and we want to talk about your focus now of your rabbinate on providing spiritual support for individuals with Alzheimer's and family members. Welcome, Dale. Nice to see you again.
Thank you. Such a pleasure to be with you.
We have so much to talk about. Dale just keynoted a morning day of clergy education here in Greater Philadelphia with the Alzheimer's Association, where the goal was to begin to orient and make clergy aware, cantors, chaplains, rabbis, of the growing need to be concerned about Alzheimer's and dementia and the role of the Alzheimer's Association. So Growing Older, you've been involved in this field of Judaism and aging. You've published a ton of books. The last one being?
Jewish Wisdom for Growing Older, Finding Your Grit and Grace
available,
Beyond Midlife.
Available how?
Jewish Lights, Amazon.
Usual.
Barnes & Noble.
Barnes & Noble and the great God Amazon. Instantaneous gratification. Get a book, which is a problem for all of us because we're out of room for books. I know that probably you, knowing your study. Why the focus now on Alzheimer's? What brought you to this stage of your career?
This is actually a turn for me because I started my career 30 years ago as a chaplain in a long-term care, continuing care retirement community. And the heart of my rabbinate at that point for 12 years was working with people who were 85 plus and many of whom had some level of dementia or had family members or care partners who had dementia. And what I learned in that setting was that it's possible to find meaning and joy and purpose and connection amid a mind which doesn't work the way it used to work.
So let me ask you the one of the bottom line questions. So for those of us who work with this community and since this is now your focus 100%.
Not 100%.
Well,
it's a good part of it.
A good part. That moment when that family member comes to you, either in the memory care unit or in a consultation, and says, "You know, Rabbi Friedman, that's not really my mom anymore." From your perspective, how do we respond to that? Because we get that that's a question. You know, that's a statement that comes up on a regular basis.
So if you asked me from my perspective as a person who thinks about the spiritual meaning of dementia, I would have one answer. If you asked me as a spiritual caregiver for that family member who says, "That's not my mom anymore," I would say something very different. Because then I'm not interested in convincing that person of anything. I'm interested in being very compassionate and very curious. Tell me about this.
So in what
way? Tell me about how your mom used to be. Mm-hmm. Tell me about what it's like for you to encounter her now that she's different.
How much does that encounter spark in the caregiver, in the family member, those really deep, 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 hidden, repressed feelings of their own mortality and fear that, is this me in 20 years?
certainly part of what's going on when the person says, oh my God, I don't even know how to cope with this. That's not mom anymore. Is what does that say about me? But I think there's something much more immediate going on. And that is, I've lost my mom.
Or dad.
I've lost my dad. The person who was X, Y, Z way all my life is not. And it is a disenfranchised grief. It's a grief that doesn't get socially or spiritually acknowledged. That caregiver, that son, that daughter, that spouse is walking around, and every encounter they have with their loved one reminds them of how different it is now. And a lot of the time, most of the time, probably that's an experience of loss. Every once in a while, though, it's a blessing.
So talk to me about that, because one of the things that rarely gets talked about in these conversations is the possibility that some real spiritual growth, bonding, new level of relationship can take place within this long-term caregiving experience that can last, as you know, with Alzheimer's, not only years, but perhaps well over a decade.
Something that I've heard from not a few, but quite a few family caregivers, particularly I would say children of people living with dementia, is that new openings happened. And sometimes those new openings had to do with how the person with dementia acted or responded or saw the world, but sometimes it has to do with what happens in the person caring. I just spoke to somebody recently who said, you know what, I realized I had a really tough relationship with this parent. And I could make myself miserable every time I encounter her. Or I could choose to move on and to experience this differently. And a lot of times something lets go mm-hmm. that's been holding, that's been niggling, that's been irritating, hurting, painful.
I mean, you've been doing this for a long time. The family of origin stuff, which fascinates me, I mean, we all know that, yes, there's always a designated caregiver in a family. And statistically now, we know it's majority, it's a woman. And as we all know, proximity to the person needing care is not necessarily the means that the person who's the caregiver could be somebody 3 hours away, because that was their role growing up. How much, in your experience in working with families dealing with this, do those family of origin roles come up, and are they sometimes, they present conflict within the family system on how to deal with this person?
Very often there's conflict, of course. And when I worked in a long-term care setting here in Pennsylvania, we would talk about the son from California. They would
in.
Be the local right. daughter caregiver who had been watching mom decline and change over many years, day to day. And then suddenly there's some health crisis and the son from California, quote unquote, would come in on his white horse and say, I'm going to save mom.
Right.
What? You're not going to do everything medical that conceivably is known to humankind to extend her life? I'm going to save her.
Right.
And, you know, there's a whole world of relationships between those siblings and that child and that parent. And you know what? Sometimes these things can get worked through.
Mm-hmm.
I am a passionate believer that as long as we're alive, we have the possibility of growing and changing and transforming our relationships. And we don't have to wait for the other person to change to mm-hmm. do that. The woman I was describing mm-hmm. before said, you know what? I've got to change my heart. I've got to change the way that I'm holding this. It's an opportunity for me. And I've heard from many people who took care of very, very, very frail parents who often couldn't talk at the end or couldn't interact, that something about giving tender care allowed them to let go and forgive.
We're speaking with Rabbi Dale Friedman, the founding director of Growing Older. We're talking about her focus now, whatever word you want me to use, rabbinate, on dealing with the spiritual aspects of families and individuals dealing with Alzheimer's disease. Dale, you're working with the person who's just been diagnosed. They'll come to you. I've just been diagnosed with this disease, maybe even early onset Alzheimer's. How do you begin to walk that person through the reality and the acceptance of this disease?
Well, there's something really basic here, which is that in doing the work of spiritual accompaniment, I don't lead anybody anywhere. And people who do spiritual care, chaplaincy or pastoral care, really our job is to walk with. So just to allow that person to talk about their terror, their anger, their worries about who's going to take care of me, how am I going to be taken care of, is that's the path. And then to look at the questions of how do I find meaning now? Mm-hmm. What is it that I can, how can I spend these days that I have while I am able to make choices about that in a very conscious way? So I think it's a deeply spiritual moment because it brings up the question of what am I doing with my life now? What have I created and built in my life that will go on beyond me? And what are the connections that I have that will support and nourish me?
If somebody wants to speak with you and this on the show now, but also, as we mentioned before, this is carried on as a podcast. How does one get in touch with you? I mean, the website is, and how does somebody maybe sitting there and saying, I really would like to talk to this person because we're beginning this journey. I'm in the middle of this journey, or the journey is coming to an end. I don't know what to do with it. How do they do that?
So the best way to reach me is through my website, www.growingolder.net.
Net.
Growingolder.net. And there's a contact me button there. I work with people in my Philadelphia office. I also work with people online through Skype or Zoom on video conference, which actually works pretty well. Mm-hmm. And I also, when people are not able to get out to me, if they're within a reasonable distance, I will make home visits as well.
Do you visit people in facilities, in a memory care unit or something? And
I would.
Would you meet? Have you met families with their mom or dad or spouse who's in a facility?
I haven't been asked to go visit in a facility because mm-hmm. sometimes facilities have their own spiritual caregiver.
Right.
But if they didn't, I would be happy to do that.
Just a practical question. The majority of our people, you know, are not members of synagogues, but many people are. And has anybody ever asked you to consult with their rabbi about this?
No, I have. Occasionally, I get calls from rabbis. What do I tell such and such?
Yeah,
you know,
okay. But never the flip side of that.
Not so much.
Okay.
But I would mention that I work with people from all faith backgrounds and no faith background.
Yeah, let's talk about that because you know, what are some of the differences you encounter of somebody, let's just say, a person who is coming from a faith background and somebody who is not? I mean, is there a greater sense of anger? Is there a greater sense of questioning? Or that really, are they all the same because it's very human?
Oh, I think the experience is human, although I wouldn't generalize because mm-hmm. each person who faces this illness faces it based on who they've been in the world and you know, how it unfolds for them and their family members are bringing, as you said, that whole, you know, trunk of baggage from their lifelong relationships.
Right.
But the thing that I believe having a grounding in a spiritual practice can give you is tools for being as resilient as possible. If you have the capacity to reach out in prayer, you can have the feeling that you are not walking this path completely alone. If you can pray for someone else, you can cultivate empathy in yourself and have a softening of your whole being if you have the capacity to meditate. You can be with this moment, and then maybe you can be with the next moment.
What's the power of prayer in all this? So the reason I ask is, many of us are familiar with all the studies. And a couple of weeks ago, we had Rabbi Wiener on from Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles in his new book on bioethics. And he spoke a lot about, he spoke about the efficacy of prayer and praying and, you know, in our tradition, the Misha Berach. And we've uncovered some rituals and meditations in one of the workshops we do in Jewish Sacred Aging on new rituals for new life stages. And I know there are a growing number of sites and individuals who are writing their own meditations for different life stages. How often are you asked to pray with a family or with a person?
I usually ask if I might, because many, many times people from our tradition or people from no tradition wouldn't even think of it. But there is something so powerful about hallowing the moment, about reaching out for however we understand that which is larger than us, that which is beyond us. And in the case of the Misha Berach, in our tradition, in the Jewish tradition, the first thing that you have to do to make a Misha Berach for somebody is say, what's your Jewish name? What's your Hebrew name? And traditionally you say, what was your mother's name? Interestingly, in a tradition where men are more commonly acknowledged than women, in the case of the Misha Berach, it's the mom that you get called by. So you are Richie, the son of
Jan, right?
Jan. And I have to just make a little discursus here to say that I had worked with this really wonderful woman who was really tough and self-possessed. And I knew her for many years in the nursing home. And when she was about 103, she broke her hip and she was in a lot of pain and had become confused. And she was sitting and she was saying, "Oi, mama, oi, mama, mama, oi, mama, oi, mama." And I said, "You're thinking a lot about your mom." And she turned right straight at me and looked me in the eyes and she said, "It's always mom in the end." And at that moment, when she was in pain and very aware that this were, these are the last pages of her book, not the last chapter, but the last pages, she was wishing to be enveloped in a mother's embrace. I think when we say Misha Berach for somebody and we use their name and their mom's name, that's what we're evoking, is that quality of like compassion. We call Rachamim in
right,
Hebrew.
Right.
So that already, just asking what's your Hebrew name, you know, for somebody who had some tangential relationship to Judaism, but they had a Jewish name, and what was your mother's name, is already heart opening. And then to offer a prayer that it somehow acknowledges what's going on with this person and what are hopes that they have expressed or concerns that they've expressed, and naming them as being among our prayers for all of those who are ailing in their bodies or in their spirits is very deeply grounding and comforting. It's an acknowledgement of what is and what's hoped for.
So one of the things that happens in long-term caregiving situations, especially with dementia or Alzheimer's, which can go on, is this thing called anticipatory grief. And I'm sure in your counseling and your work, you've bumped into people after their loved one passes away, and they may sit with you and say, you know, I'm supposed to feel this way, but I can't, I don't. And this concept of, you know, you started mourning 2 years ago. Walk me through some of, I'm sure you've dealt with this in your experience.
Well, it's interesting because in our Jewish tradition, the physical symbol of grieving is you tear your garment.
Right, the kriya ribbon.
Today, in a more sanitized version, instead of tearing your valuable Ralph Lauren shirt, you might put a little black ribbon on and tear that. But the thing is, that's a visible symbol. that your life has been torn, that something precious has been torn
right.
away. But what's really happening in caregiving with a person with dementia is that there's a little tear, a little bit every day, and it's not acknowledged. So sometimes after the fact, the person will say, I'm so relieved. Mm-hmm. You know, I was at my wits and I didn't know how I could go another day. And what part of the grief work process is to go from what it was like at the end and how hard it was. And the person may need to talk about that a lot. You know, it was so hard to see her without her dignity, or it was so hard not to have her not recognize me, or it was so hard that my dad couldn't speak. And eventually you start to reclaim more of what that relationship was and remember what it was like before and be able to connect to the whole. If you've got a parent with dementia, you may have 77 years of being in relationship with this person. And that is a part of the grieving and the healing, because when you start to connect to that, you get to miss that too. And it's like the grieving that you didn't really get to do when you were feeling that loss and that tearing little by little. So yes, at the moment, there may be tremendous relief and there is nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
And to say it was a blessing, there's nothing wrong with that. And there's more there. And not, there's no should about how you experience it, but often it goes like that. That it, you know, part of what Shiva does that's miraculous is give you back the person, because people come, if you're lucky enough to be connected, and they share memories from over that long arc of a lifetime.
Yeah, I think one of the things also you mentioned, and we talk about this, and I know even at the clergy day, and I was just at another conference, and about the caregiving thing, that there is no paradigm. You can go to Barnes & Noble and read every book. And the reality is it's still, when push comes to, it's very personal, isn't it? How we grieve, how we approach this in our own way. And there's no right or wrong. It's just very, it's been my experience that you know, we may be taught in rabbinic school, or that Kubler-Ross thing, you know, these are stages, and, well, what stage? But people just, they write their own book here, don't they?
And our lives are a lot more messy than any formula.
Well, correct. So we're talking with Rabbi Dale Friedman, the founding director of Growing Older, and her work with Alzheimer's patients and families. And I have to ask you this question, because to me it comes up all the time. And for those of us and many of our colleagues and people who may work in this area who may be listening to this at one point or another, and go back to that original question that we started with, you know, that's not my mom or that's not my dad anymore. And this image from the Talmud of the tearing away of one's da'at, of one's knowledge. In your experience in working with individuals, is it possible, and not, can't prove it, I guess, yet, is it possible that those individuals who are walking the, as you would say, the last pages of their book, that their soul, that their neshama is really in a different level of reality, a level that we in our world cannot possibly understand?
I think we have to at least allow for that possibility. And I'm so glad that you brought up the neshama, the soul, because so far we've been having a conversation for a few minutes here and we've been talking about minds and bodies, but we haven't been really talking about souls. And I really believe that as long as you're alive, you've got a soul,
mm-hmm.
and that soul has an impeccability about it that is not tarnished by fragility of brain cells.
It's not rational. And that's the thing. I can't define it. I mean, to be honest with you.
Well, and sometimes what happens is when your brain and your memory don't function the way they were, your imperfect personality evaporates away, and what's left is a luminous, beautiful soul. And, you know, sometimes what was really hard about a person just isn't there anymore. You know, maybe the experience of being cared for assiduously is actually something they never had in their life. And mm-hmm. it allows them to let go, not consciously, mm-hmm. but it allows them to be. Many people become more loving, more gentle, more grateful, more connected. They're not all living in their heads. So I don't know where the soul resides, but I do believe that there is something whole amidst the brokenness of dementia.
We don't talk about this a lot, do we, in synagogue land, in institutional, you know, of talking about, let's talk about the soul.
We talk about it in our liturgy. Yeah, one of the very first things we say is Elohai Neshamashana Tatabi. God, the soul that you've given me is pure.
But the reality is, to talk bluntly, the overwhelming majority of the 5.75 million people who identify as Jews don't set foot in synagogues and pray out
right.
of a book.
Right.
But even in, quote, adult education and all those other stuff, in congregations or JCCs or stuff like, you know, Limud programs around the United States, America, and the world, there's a lot of intellectual stuff. But it's like we really haven't given permission to talk about what that word soul means and what it means to you. It's like in congregation, they don't talk about God.
Right. And there's such a thirst. You know, the prophet says, I think it's Amos says, lo ra'av la lechem velo tzama la mayim ki im lishmoa at divrei Hashem, that time's coming when there will be no hunger for bread and no thirst for water, but rather a hunger and a thirst to connect with that which is divine. And I believe that that is present in every human being, but certainly when human beings hit the unfathomable, mm-hmm. which dementia is unfathomable, mm-hmm. whether you're the person living with the disease or whether you're the person loving the person with the disease, it's unfathomable. So then what are you going to draw on if not the awareness that we are more than our brains, if not the awareness that there is more than us in this world?
Yeah, and that's part of the caregiving journey, I think, that we really do not do such a good job of talking about in any way, shape, or form. I think we have, if my producer Steve is nodding his head. So one of the individuals who work with us on this clergy day, Nancy Hayes, just walked this walk. Nancy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Nancy. How you doing?
Okay. Hello, Rabbi Address.
Hi. Rabbi Friedman is here.
Hi,
sitting
Nancy.
Right next to me.
Hi, Rabbi Friedman.
Nice to have you with us.
Nancy, we actually, it was a good segue because we just started talking a little bit about the caregiving experience. Your husband just passed away recently due to complications dealing with Alzheimer's. You spoke eloquently at this clergy day, and you actually posted some tips on the website on JewishSacredAging.com. But, you know, for the purpose of our audience, and what was the one or two most salient, most challenging issues that you faced as a caregiver for your husband?
I think there were a few. The first one was the diagnosis. And the next one was, when do you decide that you can no longer care for the person in the way that you want, for your loved one in the way that you want to? Because your physical and mental state was changing too, as well as theirs. And I guess the third one is then once you make a decision as to their caretaking in a facility, is how do you continue to caretaking and caregiving within the facility so that you feel that you're doing the best that you can for your loved one.
And what was you just alluded to this in one of those stages, that your own changing mental state. If it's okay, can you describe that journey for yourself?
Well, we were very much partners in this process. And as he began to change, as the disease progressed and it became more and more difficult for me to have Ron at home and to care with him, even though I did have people to help me, the decision to move him into a care facility is extremely full of guilt and sadness for the caregiver, and also extremely overwhelming, because you realize that the person with the disease is not really aware of what is happening in the future. They really can't see the future at that point in the disease, and you're looking at the future and you're by yourself. No matter how much support you have, you're still, it's your decision.
Go ahead, Dale.
I was just going to comment, Nancy, about how guilt is such a pervasive part of the journey at various moments. And it's so profound to hear how devoted you were to Ron. And yet when you saw that the best care for him would be somewhere where there were other people to take care of him, that was so painful and guilt-provoking for you. I think that's such a tough part of this path.
Nancy, when did you realize that? Was there a moment? Was there a moment? Was there an action? Was there some sort of awareness, an aha moment that you realized, say, I can't, for the health and safety of my husband, we have to move to a different level?
The moment came when I returned home one evening and I had been gone for maybe half an hour, and I see the some bright lights as I was coming into the home, and I ran in, and there was a fire in our toaster, and he was standing there, and all he wanted to do was pop popcorn, and this was his way of doing it. And if I had been 10 minutes later, down along with him, so and he would have been very hurt. So at that moment, I realized that we needed to do something. Also, there were some other areas of concern that had already occurred. But it becomes a point of where you're totally exhausted, because even if you have help within the home, you sleep with one eye open or you don't sleep.
Right.
Because depending upon how the disease progresses, most of the time patients end up with a flip on their sleeping. They sleep during the day and they're up all night.
Right.
Or they nap and then they're up periodically through the night and through the day. So
Nancy,
the guilt, getting back to Rabbi Friedman's question about the guilt. So the guilt has to do with, here you're thinking you're doing the best that you can to caretake for your loved one, and things happen that are just out of your control, and you need to somehow you have to accept part of that so that the person remains safe.
We were talking a little bit before you called in about, support systems, and you alluded to the fact that no matter how the support is, you do this in many ways. The caregiver does this in splendid isolation. We also alluded to the role of prayer and stuff. You're a member of a congregation, a Temple Shalom of Broomall, Pennsylvania. What was the role of, to put it bluntly, faith? And the support of Jewish tradition. How important was that, and what role did it play in this journey that you and Ron went on, if at all?
It did play a role in terms of that we found solace in going to Friday night services when we could, and also attending other services for the high holidays in particular. Also being surrounded by our temple was very much of our friendship school, and it was an opportunity to say hello to people on Friday night services and when there were events that happened that we could both attend. People were very receptive and very kind, and some people weren't. Just like any human beings, you know, some. So our rabbi was wonderful in helping us feel comfortable. And there were moments when we would go to services and we would leave because of, you know, things were disruptive. My husband was not comfortable. And so as soon as that occurred, we would get up and leave, and that wasn't a problem. That was okay. And we got out of it what we could at that time.
So it's really wonderful to hear, Nancy, that you and Ron felt like you still had a home in the synagogue, because I have talked to a lot of people who have dementia or caregivers of people with dementia who say that they don't feel comfortable going out in community because they're embarrassed or because they feel like if the person acted in a way that was unexpected or inappropriate, that would be very much not welcome. So there's a whole area of intervention and effort that we need to engage in about creating dementia-friendly congregations, really thinking about how do we teach people to be open and compassionate to a person who might behave in ways that are unusual. How do we create an environment which is loving and accepting, and if you come for a little while and you leave or you come in and out, whatever it is, that this is your place still.
Nancy, thank you very much for calling in. And if you want to hang in, please do. But is there any concluding wishes? I mean, if you had your way to let people who are beginning or perhaps in the middle of this journey, what would be the one core element or message that you would want to leave with people?
Well, actually, Rabbi, there's two. One is that I think it's extremely important to get all your financial materials in place. Also, while the person, particularly a POA, a power of attorney, while the person is still cognizant, talk about the difficult issues such as death and dying. How my husband made his funeral. We met with our rabbi, and he discussed how he wanted his funeral to be. Very difficult to do, very difficult process, but he felt, you know, wherever the person can be in control, it's so important, because then they feel like they're still contributing to society and to their own life. I think it's really important, education, as Rabbi Freeman talked about, to make sure that not only the clergy, but also people within the community, the Jewish community, understand about the disease, and that people's perceptions are very skewed at this point about the disease. And I think there needs to be a lot more education. I thank you for inviting me on today, and I certainly would be willing to answer comments or questions that anyone has.
And if somebody does, how would they do that? How would they get in contact with you?
Through you. Through the program, if that's all
okay,
right.
Okay, that's fine. That's probably the best thing to do. And they can reach us at rabbi address at jewishsacredaging.com. And if something comes up, I can always forward it to you. So thank you, Nancy. Thank you very, very much. Wish you well. Take care. Happy
thank
Hanukkah.
You. And to you.
Take care.
Happy Hanukkah.
Take care. Dale, and we're speaking now with Rabbi Dale Friedman, the founding director of Growing Older, about her work with Alzheimer's patients and families.
Can I make a little comment about what you just said, which is I prefer to talk about people living with dementia as opposed to patients.
Okay.
Just
point.
Really trying to make sure we remember there's a person there.
Point taken. The statistics, one of the things, again, this goes back to, in many ways, where we are in a very pivotal point in the community. We're being told by the Alzheimer's Association, and parenthetically, for anybody who's walking this walk, you do need to get in touch with the Alzheimer's Association locally. They have hotlines. They have a huge amount of resources that are available to everyone, and it's in your best interest to do so. But they're telling us that the current number of about 5 million people is going to grow as boomers age out to about 15 million. At this conference, I was just at an Alzheimer's Association person was basically saying that if you're over 85 years of age in this country right now, you have a 1 in 2 chance of developing this. The community in large is not prepared for it. Certainly, if certain actions of the government that are being contemplated may impact funding for some of this and support Medicare, Medicaid. What do you think the role of the individual family and congregation is going to be in the next 20, 25 years if these statistics are true and we've seen nothing to say that they're not true?
Well, I'm sure they are true, and that there is little possibility that that's going to change radically. God willing, there will be better treatments and there will be medical advances, but those are down the road. So we are looking at ever-increasing numbers of people living with and affected by dementia, Alzheimer's, and other types.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that's true, given the new longevity, as you call it, is that we are living, many of us, in four-generation families.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that means is that caregivers who are children of people with dementia may themselves be older. Which means that they may have their own health issues and their own challenges to cope with, as well as caring, which means that the multigenerational family, I think, will have to take more responsibility, that it may be more that we'll see grandchildren caring for grandparents.
We already are.
And we have to figure out how to be truly connected communities. And it's very hard. It's easy to care for somebody who breaks a hip, goes to rehab, and comes back to their full life. It's much harder when we're dealing with a chronic and progressive illness to care as a community and figure out what's the piece that the community can do. And I have to say, honestly, we cannot make up for Medicaid. We cannot make up for Medicare. We need, most families cannot pay for the kind of care that you need.
Brutal.
That what Nancy was talking about having a caregiver in the home before it was clear that her late husband needed full-time care. We have to, as a society, pay the price for this. We can't put that on families and we can't put it on the religious community or any other community. But there is a role for families and there's a role for communities, and that everybody who's engaged in supporting people with dementia is going to need support themselves.
Right. The statistics, the AARP and National Alliance for Caregiver Family Caregivers are saying are staggering. I think the last one in the caregiving workshop that we do, the statistics that we have been given, right now there about 20-22% of caregivers are millennials, are those grandchildren. And a significant number of caregivers are people over the age of 65 who are caring for people in their 80s and 90s. So this is that's why we call this the club sandwich generation.
I have a classic story about this.
Go ahead.
So there was a man that I worked with in the nursing home who was 96. And he went to the hospital and his daughter did not come. And I immediately, in my young, judgmental way, thought, what's the matter with his daughter? Her dad's in the hospital. Well, it turned out that on the same day that dad went to the hospital at 96, the son-in-law had a heart attack and went to the hospital, and another child died.
Hmm.
So this woman, who was the caregiver for her dad, was also a bereaved sister and a caring spouse.
Yeah.
And that multiple demand in your club sandwich
it's multi-generational.
Very intense.
And as you alluded to this, and this comes up, I'm sure you see this. In fact, you kind of alluded to it before with the guy come flying in. But given the mobility of our community, the old neighborhoods are gone. So the long distance component of having to manage somebody or a caregiving situation long distance also compounds the challenges that we're facing now in this caregiving tsunami, and especially given the dementia, Alzheimer's things that we're talking about. It's a real challenge over the next 20, 30 years and probably more as how our society and what concerns me from working in congregations a lot is the majority of our congregations don't even deal with this. It's just like they don't talk about it, and yet the majority of most congregations are going to have to deal with this one way or another.
To me, that's part of the painful aspect of the invisibility of caregiving, is that congregations are filled with people who are coping with caregiving, but it's not acknowledged or visible. And it's really important to surface.
Oh, no. We push all the time the idea of, Shabbat's honoring caregivers. And there are some people who have done this. Before we start running out of time, I do want to ask you one thing, a little off the track, but something that you created. And I think it's really cool, and people need to know about that. And again, we're speaking with Rabbi Dale Friedman, the founding director of Growing Older. You're leading a trip in February specifically for?
It's a study tour for professionals to look at aging in Israel.
Okay. Now, talk to me about how long can somebody still get on? I know we're doing this in December. You leave
it's
the
probably
date?
About another week, because we leave. The trip is the 15th to the
what month? Let's start with the easy
February,
one.
February 18th to 25th. Sorry,
okay.
18th to 25th.
Okay.
And yes, there is it's a go. It's happening, but there is still room. People could contact me at www.growingolder.net and get more information about the trip. It's very exciting because we get to look at how does another society deal with aging. For example, how does a society in which a significant number of people have been traumatized in their past, as in during Israel's wars or the Holocaust, how do they meet the challenge of aging, and what does trauma-informed care look like there? For example, what does aging in place look like in a community where you didn't grow up because so many people are immigrants? What does aging in place look like if you happen to be in a community like a kibbutz? How do you deal with dementia in that society? How does socialized medicine play a role, pro or con, in the care of older people?
So there's how many days?
It's about 8 days.
Okay. And you're going to visit what cities?
We'll be in Tel Aviv, in the Galilee, and in Jerusalem.
Okay. And again, if somebody wants to, real fast, they get inspired and say, wow, this is something that I'm looking for, they want to get in touch with you, and they do that how?
www.growingolder.net.
That's cool. So that's really, I would hope that on your website you'll be posting stuff or letting people know about this. It's great. It's a great contact. I got to ask you one quick question, because it just triggered something when you were talking about this. Have you dealt with Alzheimer's, individuals living with Alzheimer's who were Holocaust survivors?
Yes.
Is there, in the dynamics that play out with that type of counseling with them and their families, is there a difference in there because of their experience?
Sure. And there are people who've done a lot of work on this subject, including in Israel, but also in Toronto. People who are survivors often have a particularly hard time with lack of control and with trust, especially if they're put into the care of people who are not their family members. So that can make coming into any kind of institutional setting very difficult. And for family members, children, particularly of people who are survivors, there's often tremendous guilt and some sense that, you know, I have to make it okay for my parent because they went through so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I can never do enough. I can never make it okay for my parent. So that's very tough. And often on both sides, letting go at the end of life is particularly painful, particularly as we are losing, you know, the very last cohort of survivors.
Right.
And we're losing that whole connection to our European past.
Yes, and on several levels. Real fast, because we have somebody on the line and I want to bring them in. The role of resilience. You alluded to this about 35 minutes ago.
I still believe in it.
I would hope so. That concept in dealing with this long-term caregiving situation with Alzheimer's and dementia, how powerful, how important is it?
We have to be, in order to cope with any major life challenge, we have to find resilience. So for the person who's caring for a family member or a loved one with dementia, the question is, where do I refill my cup?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for some people, it's going out to that garden and just digging dirt and watching growth happen. And for other people, it's like for Nancy, going to the synagogue and feeling that connection to tradition and to community. And for other people, it's having a break and going swimming.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is that nourishes one is so vitally important for maintaining resilience.
Part of this being accompanied in this journey, we're very happy and honored to bring on to the phone now, I hope, Susan Barron, who's the editor of Shema, one of the great publications within the Jewish community, whose current edition has to deal with accompanying people. And hopefully Susan's going to be part of a regular rotation here to talk about the new editions of Shema. Susan, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, welcome. You're with Rabbi Dale Friedman.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Dale. So nice to have the time to share with you.
Yes, we've been talking for the last, the show
lovely
is,
to be
is,
with you.
Is basically honoring Rabbi Friedman's work and talking about her work right now with individuals with Alzheimer's and dementia. Susan, mm-hmm. the new issue and people accompanying them on that caregiving journey and the new issue of Shema, talk to me about that real fast.
Well, the new issue of Shema is on the idea of levaya, accompaniment, and it looks at four different, it looks a lot at the accompanying people in need in different ways, though the ill, the people that are dying, the people that need accompaniment. We have four essays in every issue. One essay, which is on the cover with a beautiful piece of artwork, and that introduces our readers to the idea. Rabbi Elliot Kukla writes that piece in this issue, and that looks at four different moments of accompaniment, accompanying the ill and dying, accompanying a baby into the world, accompanying the bride and the groom to yichud, to the moments after their marriage and their chuppah, to be alone, to sanctify their marriage, and accompanying guests four steps outside of our home. So he opens up with some wonderful stories about Ruth and Naomi and the relationship they had and the way Ruth accompanied Naomi as an elder. And then we have three other essays. We have Batya Kaplan, who writes as a midwife and doula about helping babies into the world. Rabbi Richard Adress wrote a wonderful piece. Richard, I'm going to let you speak about that a little bit more. But you write about this eldering journey and losing people along the way and how we address that. And Rabbi Sarah Pasha Orlo, who is a hospital chaplain in Boston, writes about training chaplains in their work and what a chaplain can and can't do and the importance of being present for people. And then we have our back page. We call it Nishma. It's a simulated Talmud page. And we have three writers writing about the importance of friendship. They're very short pieces, and each speaks to the other one. And they look at the verse from Ta'anit, from the Talmud, either friendship or death. Give me friendship or death.
So
Susan, that's what's in the issue.
How does one access Shema? How does one get a hold of this?
Right. It's printed every month as an insert in the foreword, and one can buy a subscription to the foreword and receive the hard copy, mm-hmm. or one can access it free online, and I can give you the link.
Go ahead.
www.forward.com/shma-now. So I'll say that one more time. www.forward.com/shma-now.
Okay.
And if people would like to send me an email, I can send them the link to sign up for our monthly newsletter, and that introduces every issue, and then you can know when every issue is posted online.
So, and if somebody wants to sign up for that, how do they do that?
It's very simple. It's free, and you'll then be notified every month that a new issue has been posted online, and you can go to the website, read the issue. It's also, you can download the PDF, and that's also free. And you could send me an email, and then I'll send you the link. It's a long link, and I don't want to, you know, in the podcast give it out. But you can just send me an email at sberrin@shma.com.
So sberrin@shma.com, and that'll get you involved in getting involved with the newsletter and eventually leading you to the PDF, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So thank you. And
right.
I really do appreciate you coming on and giving us the heads up on the current issue of Shema. And hopefully we can do this every month. And if I'm not mistaken, you're going to be with us for a longer interview sometime in February, right?
That's right. That's right.
Super.
And I'll tell you a little bit about the history of Shema and how I came to edit it, what's upcoming.
Thank you. Susan, thank you very much. Have a great Hanukkah, and I appreciate you calling in and giving us the heads up on Shema. Thank you for the opportunity of writing.
You're very welcome. I'm so glad that you contributed to the issue. You have so much to say
thank
about
you.
It. And Dale, so nice to spend some time with you, even if it's
Susan,
just on the telephone.
Great to hear your voice.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Susan.
Bye-bye.
We're just about out of time, Rabbi Friedman, so I want to thank you very much for joining us and giving us the benefit of your wisdom and insight and experience, and I wish you well. Have a Nesiyah Tova Ba'aretz, and I'm glad that's going. Thank you very much. And again, real fast, somebody wants to get a hold of you, they get you by?
www.growingolder.net.
Thank you all for being part of today's podcast and broadcast on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows are going to be archived, as you know, as podcasts on JewishSacredAging.com. We invite you again your comments to rabbiaddress@JewishSacredAging.com. And please like the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page where we also discuss the upcoming shows. Again, these shows are produced at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media here in beautiful Cherry Hill, New Jersey, under the control of our producer, Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for listening. We look forward to greeting you again on the next edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio here on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you. I'm your host, Richard Address.